HBpodcraft.com.
The two men lay down without undressing upon their beds of soft balsam boughs cunningly arranged. Inside, all was warm and cozy. But outside, the world of crowding trees pressed close about them, marshaling their million shadows and smothering the little tent that stood there like a wee white shell facing the ocean of tremendous forest. Between the two lonely figures within, however, there pressed another shadow that was not a shadow from the night. It was the shadow cast by the strange fear, never wholly exorcised, that had leaped suddenly upon Defago in the middle of his singing. And Simpson, as he lay there, watching the darkness through the open flap of the tent, ready to plunge into the fragrant abyss of sleep, knew first that unique and profound stillness of a primeval forest when no wind stirs, and when the night has weight and substance that enters into the soul to bind a veil about it. Then sleep took him.
That was the conclusion of the second chapter of The Wendigo by Algernon Blackwood, which we are in the midst of covering here on HBpodcraft.com. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and this is our exploration into weird fiction as dictated by H.P. Lovecraft.
That's right. In his essay, Supernatural Horror and Literature, he talks about this story in particular with a lot of fondness. Our reader, of course, this week is once again Andrew Lehman. He puts the Mac in Macabre. He is our guy.
So outstanding.
And we've been having a good time talking about this. I'll just give you a quick summary on where we are so far in the story.
Do it.
Last time on our show, we had two Scotsmen,
bam,
Dr. Cathcart and his nephew Simpson, and they're on a trip into the Canadian wilderness to hunt moose. They're accompanied by Hank, their guide, also Defago, who's another French-Canadian guide, and Punk, who is the Native American cook and was the opening act for Blondie at CBGB back in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
That's how I got the name. There aren't a lot of moose out in the Canadian wilderness on this trip. So the team decides to split up. Simpson and Defago, they go off into an area called 50 Island Water. Woods seem just eternal. It's a huge,
yeah,
huge wilderness.
Majestic.
And there's an odd smell on the wind, right?
Yeah, something doesn't smell quite right.
And it's not necessarily because they had fires there the previous year, although a good portion of the forest there is burnt up. As we head into this third chapter, Defago, he seemed disturbed by the scent on the wind, and he had mentioned for the first time, but only briefly, the legend of the Wendigo.
The Wendigo.
Which he said is something that drunks talk about. He said it's a sort of great animal that lives up yonder, quick as lightning in its tracks and bigger than anything else in the bush, and ain't supposed to be very good to look at. That's all we really know, but he drops that right before everybody goes to bed. And that's where we get into chapter 3. That's where we left off.
Now, this concerns Simpson suddenly waking and realizing that he's already woken up and his eyes were open.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing where you didn't even realize you're awake. You slowly come into consciousness.
And he thinks he hears something when he realizes Defago is crying.
Yeah, that's what woke him up, presumably. He's not just crying. He's like sobbing, holding up his blanket,
yeah,
trying to keep the sound muffled.
Now, there's some beautiful writing here where he just talks about how this man crying makes him feel. This intimate human sound heard amid the desolation about them woke pity. It was so incongruous, so pitifully incongruous, and so vain. Tears in this vast and cruel wilderness, what avail? He thought of a little child crying in the mid-Atlantic.
Yeah. And this chapter is really short.
Yeah.
It's just this one little occurrence where he wakes up and he's thinking Defago's crying. And this is, Defago's been very masculine and very up till this point.
Oh, yeah. He's a tough outdoorsman.
Right.
And so he's crying. And then he kind of nudges him and he says, Defago, are you okay? What's wrong? Are you in pain? Are you? And then he just kind of, and then just is quiet again. And then he hears him sort of breathing steady, like he's asleep. So he was kind of crying in his sleep.
Yeah. And the other odd thing, though, is that he's moved from his straw that he's sleeping on. He's kind of been pulled out of the tent a little bit. His feet are on. What's that?
Way that you're framing it, he doesn't say it that way at this point in the story. He just says, oh, he must have scooted out a little bit.
Right,
in his
right.
Sleep.
Oh, the fact that I'm saying he was
you're,
pulled
you're
out.
You're saying that he was pulled out a little bit in his sleep, which is a conclusion that Simpson comes to later in the story. At this point, he just goes, Boy, he must have wiggled his feet out of the tent.
Hey, well, his feet are uncovered and they're coming. Yeah, they're coming out of the tent. And I imagine it's very cold. So that's pretty odd.
Yeah. But frickin' Simpson, he's such a nice guy. He takes some of his blanket and covers up Defago's feet with his blanket.
Right. He doesn't want to disturb him by moving his position. Yeah. Because he doesn't want him to wake up. And here, I think, and that's really all that happens in the chapter.
That's it.
Then Simpson kind of goes back to sleep. But I was thinking about this as I was rereading how, you know, your feet are so vulnerable. They're almost like an antennae for irrational horror. I think about when you're a kid, you're afraid of monsters under the bed, and isn't a lot of that because when you're sitting on the bed, your feet are exposed down there.
Right.
And something could just reach out and grab you.
It's a very vulnerable spot on you, as in, you know, if something happens to your feet, you fall.
Yeah, it's how you can run away from scary things. I mean, think of it, Shaggy would have died like two episodes into Scooby-Doo if his feet weren't working. But also the fact when you're out in the wilderness against the elements, if you don't have good shoes, even if it's a humid climate, if you don't keep your feet dry and kept well, I mean, you're in a lot of trouble.
I never would have thought of my feet as being a vulnerable part, but now that you pointed out, yeah, they are.
Well, geez, if you look at horror movies, oftentimes just to build tension, they'll just show you somebody's feet. I think of there's a scene right at the beginning of that remake of Dawn of the Dead where they show her put her feet down on the carpet, and it just gives you this, yes, she's in a lot of trouble. She's very vulnerable. There's nothing more vulnerable than having feet that are uncovered and you have things to do, you have things to escape from. And I don't know, just for me, I was so scared that I was going to get snatched, that my feet were going to get grabbed, I was going to get pulled away when I was a little kid by whatever was under
the
bed.
No, that's a common feeling, yeah. I felt that as well, and I'm sure other people do, especially, yeah, you flip off the light switch and then run and jump to the bed so that your feet wouldn't be close to the end of the bed, because that's how a monster can grab you.
Yeah, I bring it up here because it's sort of tagline of the story about the feet. It comes off kind of funny, but it really is, I'm thinking about it more, I think the naked foot is kind of a metaphor for mankind in general in this story. Because we don't have claws, we don't have pads, we don't have fur on our feet.
No.
We don't have anything that animals naturally have to protect themselves against the elements.
Yeah.
And so that naked foot really represents man and all of his weakness against the elements. And it also represents a kind of de-evolution when later Defago goes traveling, and we're going to get to that, but when he goes traveling with the Wendigo, his feet change.
Yeah.
And in
Spoiler alert,
but if you become a part of the wilderness, if you go out there, you're going to dehumanize. And that part of you that is essentially human, which is that unprotected naked foot, is going to turn into something else. I don't know. It was just all stirring up in my head.
Wow, that is very insightful, Pfeiffer. Good one. I never would have pulled that together.
Anyhow, that gets us into chapter 4.
Now, Simpson had went back to sleep after that whole incident with the crying and the feet. Something moves through the tent, as in like something was inside with him, moves out, shakes him. Moves the tent. Simpson's really confused, doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know where he is. He tries to talk to Defago, but Defago's not responding.
Well, he's sitting up and he's shivering and he's shaking. I think he's actually shrinking against Simpson in some kind of terrible, terrible fear. Whatever it was that moved through the tent, it's hard to tell.
And next, almost simultaneous with his waking, it seemed, the profound stillness of the dawn outside was shattered by a most uncommon sound. It came without warning or audible approach, and it was unspeakably dreadful. It was a voice, Simpson declares, possibly a human voice, hoarse yet plaintive. A soft, roaring voice close outside the tent, overhead rather than upon the ground, of immense volume, while in some strange way, most penetratingly and seductively sweet. It rang out, too, in three separate and distinct notes or cries, that bore in some odd fashion a resemblance, far-fetched yet recognizable, to the name of the guide. Defago.
A creepy voice is outside. Some intelligence is calling out Defago for some reason.
When later Simpson recalls it, he says it's a sort of windy, crying voice, as of something lonely and untamed, wild and of abominable power. Glad the abominable adjective got worked. But Defago, on hearing this, springs to his feet and just rushes out of the tent almost supernaturally fast. And as he's going, he calls out,
Oh, my feet of fire! My burning feet of fire! Oh, this height and fiery speed!
And that line was used in a very popular 1970s disco song. Right?
Are you talking about Disco Inferno?
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that from Disco Inferno?
Oh, my feet of fire. I think that's
burning feet of fire.
The first time I read this, I laughed at that.
Yeah, well, I know you made jokes about this a lot. And when I read it, I didn't think it was funny because I was on board, man. The story's got me.
But I thought it was cool a second ago when his name got called out.
Oh, yeah. No, man, I thought this is all cool. And he just shoots out of the tent and he's gone. And it takes Simpson a few seconds to go, like, what the hell just happened? He's scared. He can hear DeFago's voice kind of dying off in the distance.
Yeah.
And then he finally comes out. You know, he doesn't run out after him immediately. He just kind of, what the hell is going on? And then he finally has to build the courage up to go outside, and it's morning.
DeFago's nowhere to be seen.
Yeah.
He's just gone. That smell is in the air. And he's saying it's kind of sickly sweet, like decaying vegetation or like the earth.
But he also says it's almost like a lion, like the odor of a lion or a predator, I think is probably the more appropriate approach to it.
That's what he settles on, that it's most like a lion.
I've never smelled a lion, so I can't. Have you smelled a lion?
Have I
I've smelled a gorilla. They smell horrible. They smell like rotten onions. I mean, because like I'm into gorillas and the great apes. I think they're pretty amazing and I respect them. And it was in the separate enclosure and it was sick, so they had to keep it away from the other ones. And I was just over by a friend of ours who worked at the zoo, who's a veterinarian whose specialty is gorillas. I said, whoa, what is that? Is it because it's sick? And she goes, oh, no, they all smell like that. Really? That's horrible. And you work with gorillas. And she goes, oh, I like it now. I love that smell.
Well, they're not taking showers.
Of course not. But I don't know. When I watch these nature shows, I think of the smell of forest and jungle, that humidity. I feel that. I see that.
Mm-hmm.
But that smell, it was not something that I was prepared for at all. And if I was out in the wilderness, I probably would have smelt that times 20.
Oh, right.
Because there's a ton of those guys out there.
That's the thing when you watch nature documentaries, you're like, we need to get back to the land, man. And then you actually get out there, you're like, it smells like dookie out here. And there's so many bugs. That's the thing that you never really see in the things. The insects that are destroying you because there's way more of them than there are pleasantly mannered orangutans. There's, you know, those are the things that are after you.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to note that when it's the DeFago, his name gets called.
DeFago.
I was directing this play in college and I was trying to, there was a creepy scene.
Wait, you were directing this play?
No. It was just a play.
Oh.
But there was a really creepy scene in it and I was trying to get the actor to, you understand, you know, that feeling you get in the middle of the night? You know, if you're laying in bed and sometimes you'll whisper your own name and just hearing it makes you feel really spooky and scared. And he kind of looked at me and he goes, why are you whispering your own name at night? Like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, I don't know. It's just, you ever try and scare yourself? It's kind of the same thing as like you look in a mirror at night or something and make a scary face. Like, you say your name and it's like the worst sound. You don't want to hear your proper name whispered by anybody when you're, you know, it's dark. But I laughed at myself because I'm like, maybe that's just something I do. He had no idea what I was talking about.
I've never done that.
I don't do it all the time, but I think when I was a kid, I was just, you try and test the threshold of how scary something will be.
That would be, I think, scary. Absolutely.
Right.
However, as a child, I did not search out those things. I actively avoided those things.
Anyhow, we're getting way off topic. Simpson goes out and DeFago's not there.
He's not there and he realizes he's got to find DeFago because he's his guide and he's out there by himself. So he starts just calling for DeFago. Nothing. No response. And that horror is realized in this very moment where he's like, oh no, this dude just ran off after some crazy thing. I don't know where he is or if he's coming back or what.
Yeah, there's moments where he kind of loses his mind. And I think this is right in the beginning when he's just running around screaming his name.
Yeah, he goes a little crazy at this point.
It's good that he's able to find his way back to the camp. He kind of gets his crap together. He eats a little bit. I think some hot coffee and some bacon put a little sense into him again. And says, he's like, I'm freaking out and behaving like a boy. He puts some things together at the camp and then he tries a better search.
Well, I mean, it's also because there's tracks, there's snow. You don't have to be an expert tracker to flip and follow a person's footprints in the snow. And it's fresh snow, so it doesn't have time for a lot of animals or melting or any of that stuff. So he figures, okay, I'm going to leave a note. Because if DeFago comes back, I want him to know where I'm going, and I'm just going to follow his tracks. He notices that there's another set of tracks.
Yeah, this is like he's vacillating between madness and rationality. So at first he freaks out, then he calms down, then he starts tracking, and then he sees, oh, there's this other set of tracks.
It's a moose. That's what he thinks.
Everything makes sense now. DeFago got wind of a moose. He was so excited about it. He just took off. That's what's going on, right?
Right, and then he goes, wait, no. That doesn't make sense. Something's not right here because DeFago acted like a crazy person, not a trained woodsman, which is what he is. He's a guy who's been doing this his whole life. He wouldn't just run out with, you know, in his sleep clothes, not grabbing a weapon, not being prepared, You know, he knows how to track animals, so why would he feel the need to immediately run after it? The more he starts looking at those footprints, he realizes those aren't moose feet. They're something else. And he realizes that that smell, that really strong odor of the predator, of the lion, is really close to these tracks. Every time he gets close to the tracks, he smells it even stronger. And he starts to go a little crazy again because he realizes his explanation doesn't work.
It's pretty disturbing to him.
He gets a little crazy again. He feels the woods closing in on him, and it's kind of a vertigo. I picture the sort of the camera tracking in and then the focus shifting. So it's the whole, but he pulls it together. He's like, if I'm going to survive this, I've got to find him. So I'm going to keep going. And he follows those tracks for miles.
And then something odd starts happening with the tracks.
Yeah, he notices that they are getting further and further apart. Like the creature is starting to take larger and larger steps. Maybe it's running. But what he also notices is that DeFalco's steps are also getting further and further apart.
Yeah, and we're talking about a stride of like 18 feet between these things. So it's not, this is leaping through the, this is like Incredible Hulk stuff.
Yeah, that's not, nobody leaps 18 feet.
And I guess that was another thing on my, it's strange how a read can change, because the first time I read it, that was funny to me too, because I imagine this monster, he's got DeFalco on his side and they're just kind of skipping through the air, you know, like flying up these huge distances. And that seemed funny to me.
Yeah, your reading of it was very different than mine, because to me that was horrific and weird. And preternatural and creepy and cool. Yeah, I don't know what younger Chad Pfeiffer was thinking when he read this the first time.
In this recent reading of it, I didn't feel those things as acutely. I don't know. I guess I was just in a goofy mood when I read it before. But this time I did see, boy, the weirdness of that is really, this guy's disappeared. He's your guide. And then when you're tracking him, it seems like this insane thing is happening. It just defies logic. And to be out there alone and confronted with this is a lot more terrifying than I was attributing to it before. I mean, this is almost like... isn't there an urban legend about Spring-Heeled Jack? Isn't that his whole thing?
Oh, right, yeah. It was in London, right? He was one of those guys, Spring-Heeled Jack?
We should talk about it in the next episode. I can do some research, or maybe people can write in about it. But from a long time ago, I remember reading about Spring-Heeled Jack being a 19th century urban legend around, England. But he's called Spring-Heeled Jack because he would take these huge, long leaps.
Right.
If you found his tracks, it would make sense how he could get from one point to the next. Anyhow, the last thing I want to say about this chapter, because we're going to chapter 5, is there's such a profound sense of loneliness when he's looking for DeFalco. And it's something that it was tipped that this would happen when DeFago's like, anything happens to me.
Yeah.
Like we talked about in the last episode. It doesn't happen much in adult life where you're confronted with that, unless specifically you're doing something like this. You're taking a camping trip or some kind of guided thing out into the wilderness. But certainly I can remember being a little kid and getting lost.
Sure.
Getting separated from your parents that first time at a department store or...
Yeah, that panic that sets in, that real deep-rooted fear, because you just don't know what the heck you're supposed to do.
And if you can't find them, I mean, they are like the only persons you can trust.
Yeah.
Everything else becomes menacing to you. And,
yep.
And you have that feeling because your experience with the world is somewhat limited. I remember did you go to the Putnam Museum when you were a kid in Davenport, Iowa? They had that great mummy exhibit there. There was Isis the mummy. I was very scared of them, but also fascinated by them.
Of course.
I went with my mother and my sister. We went to see the mummies. I was already in a creepy feeling. And then they took the stairs. It was only a 2-level thing. I decided to take the elevator.
Mm-hmm.
And the elevator got stuck.
Whoa.
They didn't tell them I was getting into the elevator. I was being a clever little kid and thought I'd beat them down there. I don't know what I wanted to do. And in that moment, I was so alone.
Yeah.
I was, and I don't know how old I was, but pretty young. And just thinking I might never see, I figured I'm going to die in here,
Yeah.
Or the lights are going to go out at least, and they're just going to not know where I'm at. So they're going to go somewhere else to look. And then I'm going to be in here alone with those goddamn mummies.
Yeah.
It was horrible. It turns out, I think I just forgot to hit the button. It wasn't even stuck. Like the doors opened again, and then I realized I was on the same floor, and then somebody got in and barely looked at me and hit the thing, and then we were going.
Oh.
So everything was okay, but I was so scared.
I had a similar, I remember I was at a Kmart with my mom, and the clothes have those sort of circular hanging racks.
Oh, right.
I climbed in the center of one of those and hid from my mom, and I thought it was going to be a funny joke, and she looked around for me and not know where I was. And then I kept waiting for her to like look around, and then I came out and she was just gone.
Oh no.
I remember that what you were saying, that terrifying feeling of just not knowing what you're supposed to do. And I don't honestly remember what I did. I do remember being at a counter with somebody that worked there. I remember seeing my mom. I don't remember what happened from that moment of, oh my God, I'm by myself, where's my mom? Cut to seeing my mom, but I don't remember how I found her or she found me. That gives you an idea of how terrified I was.
Absolutely. And I don't think as adults we're actually as far away from that feeling as we think we are. We just have a better mastery of the world in terms of where the safe places to go are.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't take much to remove that and I think that overwhelming sense of terror of being lost is still something that we're able to feel. And I think that's what's going on with Simpson.
Yeah.
Here.
Well, that leads us into chapter 5. One of the funny things here where it kind of goes into this and said, you know, most people would be crazy at this point, totally nuts, and not being able to cope with the situation. But Simpson was a Scot, yeah. So he's fine.
Scots have a more common sense, I guess, or something like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Well, I remember from reading The Screaming Skull that they seemed to not. Well, or at least the servants in there, they were unimpressed by the English specters because they thought Scotland had a monopoly on the supernatural.
Yeah.
So I was surprised that here the Scots are characterized as, no, these are earthy, skeptical, reasonable people.
Well, the Scots are just tough, I think, is the implication that they can handle pretty much anything because they grew up in Scotland.
They had a deal with Mel Gibson.
Exactly. What?
The footprints. He's still following them.
And this is a weird thing. He said that they started to seem to have kind of a red hue to it, but not as if the snow was colored, but as if there was some kind of lighting effect, like it was catching the light in just the right way, that it was reflecting kind of reddish light. And then he also happens to notice that Defago's footprints begin to seem slightly different, like they're changing. And that eventually, as he keeps following these tracks, they look like smaller versions of the animal footprints that he's chasing.
Defago's feet are changing.
He's becoming the creature that he's chasing. I would be thinking, I'm probably losing my mind right now to be seeing these types of things, especially being out in the wilderness. And then the tracks just disappear.
Right.
And that's it.
And then he hears Defago's voice, seemingly everywhere and nowhere. It's just out up in the trees somewhere. Simpson freaks out again and he's running around. He's tripping and falling down and calling out Defago's name. And he gets the capitalized here. The panic of the wilderness is what called to him when he heard that voice. The power of untamed distance, the enticement of the desolation that destroys. It's all about this loneliness and the fact that he's out there. And then it says he gets a vision of Defago eternally hunted, driven, and pursued across the skyey vastness of those ancient forests. He can only hear his voice, but he has no idea where he went to. And so he just runs.
He gets lost because he's in a panic right now, but eventually he stops and he looks around and realizes, wait a minute, what am I doing? I can't do this. I will die. I need to pull myself together and get back to camp. Fortunately, because there is snow, he's able to follow his own tracks back.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, he realizes it's midday, so he's going to have to kind of hustle to get back before the sun goes down. And he does.
He gets back there, but it's a really horrifying track back to the camp.
Yeah.
You know, it says the shadow of the woods, which used to be covering, they're now menacing and challenging.
Yeah.
I mean, everything is rough for him.
Yeah, he keeps seeing things out of the corner of his eye, keeps hearing noises, he's super paranoid. The sun is setting, but he gets back in time and he gets a fire going. He realizes he's not going to be able to take the canoe back, so he just has to camp here by himself for the night.
I mean, he sits up all night with a fire, right?
Yeah, he doesn't go to sleep, obviously.
He doesn't go to sleep.
He just keeps the fire going all night and stays awake, which, can you imagine just going through that whole day of trying to, just mentally of what he had to deal with, but physically going through that wilderness all day, just tracking this guy and then running around and being all crazy and then coming back? He would have been so exhausted. And then to stay up all night, that is being really scared.
Yeah, definitely. After his terrible vigil all night, he packs up and he leaves a note for Defago, and he leaves behind matches and supplies.
Yeah.
And things that Defago might need if he comes back to the camp. It just felt really sad in this part of the story to me because Defago's gone. Whatever he was is gone. We might see him again, but the metaphor of this on a really simple level is that nature eventually is just going to take people. And you know, this character of Simpson, he's younger than everybody else. He's this divinity student. His only experience is with Aberdeen. And this is his first trip into unspoiled nature, the real world. Yeah. And one of the first things he experiences is this loss. And it's out of his control. I was reading this and I was thinking about it this morning. I was out of coffee, so I ran over to the coffee shop. And, you know, I live on a street where there are various accidents, car accidents, motorcycle accidents, that kind of thing. And things that just happen.
Mm-hmm.
And people do these makeshift memorials,
yeah,
where they put out candles and flowers and pictures of the people they've lost on the street corner. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
You know, I saw two of those this morning when I was just going over to get my coffee. Big piles of things that people have left for the deceased.
Yeah.
And it, because I was reading this at the time, it made me think of the same thing. It's like he went out into nature. Nature took Defago away from him, but he's still leaving things for him, hoping that he'll come back.
Who knows what happened to Defago? I mean, he's probably dead, sure, but he's not positive he's dead. And what if he does need food? And What if he does come back? And, you know, it's hope.
It's hope. This struck me as so sad because there's a loss here.
Oh, yeah.
We've been talking about being lost and being lonely and how, yes, there's that selfishness about you. I want the guide to lead me out of here. But there's also, these guys became friends. Just the night before, Defago was singing and they were hanging out together and they were sleeping in the tent together. And now he's just lost him.
No, I think when he does leave those things, if I was him, if I was Simpson, I would just assume he was dead. There's no way he's going to survive that and he's not coming back. He ran out in his bedclothes.
Yeah.
And he's been out there all day and all night. There's no way he's surviving that.
No, but you gotta try.
Of course, you have to try. And that's what he was doing.
He leaves those supplies behind and he takes another harrowing trip. Luckily, Defago had helped him with finding the canoe. He's able to get in the canoe, go back to the other camp. And it's about midnight when he finally finds Hank and Punk and his uncle. It says they ran quickly down and helped a very exhausted and broken specimen of Scotch humanity over the rocks. So that gets us into chapter 6. Obviously, Simpson's all screwed up. So I think, you know, he needs to get some sleep.
Yeah.
Before he tells him everything, that because they can't go out in the middle of the night anyway.
When he first gets in, he sees his uncle and then he realizes, oh, wait, I went nuts out in the woods. It didn't really make sense to him that he went a little crazy when he was out there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he knew he kind of panicked at a few moments, but of seeing people sane, he got that perspective of, you know, like, oh, wait, I went to some crazy places. I was out of my mind.
Right.
And he felt ashamed, which was kind of I never would have thought about that. Like, he felt ashamed that he couldn't be in control of himself.
Yeah.
He was ashamed that he left Defago as well. He goes, you know, I should have stayed and kept looking. And he started feeling just really bad about the whole thing. Of course, he shouldn't have. He was awesome. He did great stuff. The doc realizes that he's kind of going through this stuff. He is still actually a little out of his mind. And he needs some sleep, like you were saying. And the doc gives him a shot of morphine. And I was like, wait, he carries morphine with him on hunting trips?
Well, sure. Yeah, if somebody gets injured, you'd need that.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah.
And I don't think he gives him too much. I mean, he gives him enough. It puts him down for about 6 hours. But yeah, it was sudden. Whoa, morphine.
I mean, I wouldn't have thought. But I guess if he's got a doctor bag with him, there's probably morphine in it. But I wasn't ready for it.
And it says for 6 hours, he slept like the dead. Yeah, as you say, he feels a little embarrassed that he was crazy. But I think he does believe some of the things that he saw. It's just that he doesn't want to tell these guys yet.
I think he's not sure.
Right.
At this point in the story, he's going, I think I saw these things, but I'm going to stick to the stuff that sounds believable because that's probably the truth of it.
Yes, exactly. And he does that. He tells them only really about that there was the crazy smell that Defago vaguely spoke about the Wendigo. I think that the doctor actually starts getting it out of him because they go, all right, we got to go out. We got to look in an organized way. We got to do it at once. Just based on what Simpson said so far. And as they're preparing for that and they're traveling, Cathcart starts kind of using his skills to get more information out of his nephew.
Yeah, because he's a psychologist and psychiatrist.
Exactly.
He's able to figure out that Defago suffered some sort of manic attack, was a bit delusional, and probably just ran off into the woods. That happens. That's something that people do. He tells him about Defago because he mentions Defago was crying in his sleep, the whole Wendigo and all those things. And he goes, yeah, that sounds like he was going through a nervous breakdown of some kind. The doc, you know, keeps saying things to him to make him feel better. Like, you did a great job. You went above and beyond. You're awesome. But tell me some more. Really manipulating him. And the doc makes some good explanations and just says, yeah, this is what was going on. It was probably a moose. And then it was just too much for him. But the smell was strange. This whole weird smell thing. Smell is not something that people usually hallucinate,
right?
So, according to him, that's a strange that he can't quite explain.
I normally relate to the skeptic in these weird tales.
Yeah,
and I feel bad for them because I know the world that they're in is not
right
this world. But I relate to them, and I like. But Blackwood has he's not somebody who's a fan of rationalists. I think in his own philosophy, he does manage to make Dr. Cathcart into kind of a. I don't like him that much at this point. Even though he's being reasonable, it's the way he describes what he's doing psychologically to Simpson, how he, as you were saying, he builds him up and then he dismisses everything he says.
Yeah.
It almost feels like he's the husband in the yellow wallpaper or something like that. I mean, he's got explanations for everything.
Yeah.
The only thing he can't explain is that odor. But everything else, he goes, no, it was just this. Well, you were confused. I mean, you did a great job, and anybody would be, you know, freaked out if they were dealing with that.
Yeah.
But you're wrong about everything. Even Simpson, he says it was so easy to be wise in the explanation of an experience one has not personally witnessed. So I think even Simpson is sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what was going on. I was just sick and okay. But in his heart, he knows the real truth is somewhere between maybe the rational things that his uncle is saying and then what he actually experienced. But, hey, he's about to take the guys out to the scene of the crime, so they're going to get a first-hand experience with
the Wendigo.
And that seems like a good place for us to pause.
Yes.
Looks like we're going to be doing three episodes on this one. So next time we'll be able to conclude once they get out there, what's going to happen, Chris?
I don't know. Well, actually, I know. I've read the whole story, but it's fun. It's good stuff.
Yeah, it is good stuff. I'm really digging this story.
It's a ripping yarn. I want to thank Andrew Lieben for his outstanding reading, as always.
Thank you, Andrew. Really appreciate it.
I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcast.com.
hppodcast.com.